Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
Hello, and welcome to Bookworm. This is Michael Silverblatt, and today my guest is Robert Stone, the author most recently of Damascus Gate, the author as well in order of A Hall of Mirrors, Dog Soldiers, A Flag for Sunrise, Children of Light, Outer Bridge Reach, a book of short stories, Bear and His Daughters, and Damascus Gate. Now, every time I see Robert Stone, I've said to him in one tone of presumption or another, when are you going to write something with the density and complexity and fearsomeness of A Hall of Mirrors? Well, at last, he really has. This is Damascus Gate. Not that the other books were any mean feats, but it seems to me that this really is another book, like A Hall of Mirrors, in which you are throwing in everything you know.
Right. I did that with A Hall of Mirrors because that's what first novelists do. They tend to put every single thing they know into their book. And this, in a way, I almost consciously got back to that. I mean, I simply decided to do it. When I discovered on second visit that Jerusalem contained the sort of milieu that I've always written about, that there were journalists and international social workers and missionaries and the struggle between powers, international and local, hustlers, promoters, seekers, dreamers, all the sorts of people whose fortunes I've always monitored in a way because I always thought they reflected my concerns. As soon as I realized that, I knew that I was almost condemned to write this book. And sometimes I really felt as that I was laboring. I have an image of Samson somewhere in the book turning a wheel, and sometimes I felt a little bit like that. But it really was as though I took it required everything I had to get myself out from the predicament of having commenced to write this book.
It seems that in addition to Israel, which is actually the background, it seems to me, not the subject of the book. The subject of the book seems to be the nature of the quest for the holy, for the kadosh, and how people fall away at their quest's end from actual attainment, and that this quest may be about the degree to which you approach something holy before you are rebuffed by either your own lack of consequence or its indifference to you. So it seems that in addition to the world of the Mideast, there's an enormous range of spiritual literatures that appear in the book as well, taken seriously. The narrator's father is a member of the Frankfurt School, and so he reads, the narrator does, Chris Lucas, Gershom Scholem, Walter Benjamin. He's a serious man, a religion major, now a journalist, and he is in a way wrestling with texts, it seems to me, as are all of the other pilgrims in the Holy Land. What was your reading like, your investigation for this?
Well, on the level of documents, the first book I read was Scholem's Life of Sabbatai. And, of course, the story of Sabbatai is to some degree reflected. It's not precise. There's no congruency or exactness. But the character of the deluded, manic depressive, and the young, dynamic communicator sort of echo the relationship of Sabbatai and Nathan of Gaza as described by Sholem. I read studies of Pico della Mirandola's work on Kabbalah. I read a book on Spanish Christian Kabbalists. I read Esterly's monograph on the cult of Sabazios, Sabaoth. I did quite a lot of reading. I'm indebted to the Yale Divinity School for a lot of these researches. I mean, of course, this is reading that was congenial to me in any case. I mean, I read the Paulus Prested edition of the Zohar, which I think Borges had started me reading years ago.
Well, that's what I wanted to note here, that the reading, in fact, is congenial, that it is almost impossible for someone who's read your other books not to see that the narrator here shares, or that the protagonist shares spiritual concerns with its author that are genuine concerns, that the nature of a holy quest is for Robert Stone a central question of the modern world, not the ancient world, and that to let listeners who may not know about Sabbatai Tzvi, he was the famous false messiah whom people actually in droves followed to their own destruction. Now the point becomes that the religious devotions of a false messiah are the same as those of a true messiah. And so the evidence that would greet the eye of the characters in Damascus Gate as they face the possibility that Adam de Kauff is the real thing, these are not evidences which are susceptible to refutation. You follow or you don't. That is, in a sense, the heart of this book.
Right. That's true. That is the heart of the book. And the confusion attendant on the fact that someone once said, God speaks to us, if he speaks to us, in murmurs, never in words, never in a vocabulary that we can immediately translate. And the world is full of murmurs. And to detect from among those murmurs what is actually divine requires an act of faith. And the act of faith is not insured in any way. It is, the risk is real, and the result of a misplaced act of faith can be spiritually, emotionally, psychologically devastating. But the leap has to be taken.
Now, politically, though, at another level of Damascus Gate, there are those who see that the zealotries and extremities of the religious questers can be manipulated for political purposes. And so the small group of indeed extremely troubled followers of de Kauff, of the group he is the least troubled, his problems are basically medical. His followers have many other disorientations, to say the least. But de Kauff is placed in a context where it will look like his group is setting a bomb to blow up the Muslim holy places on the sacred mountain. This is, in turn, a plot that involves several of the political factions in Israel. Now, you have then created a novel which is questioning the relationship between the spiritual bond and the worldly one, the political one, and I wondered how that emerged in the course of the writing.
Well, it's always a problem when religious impulses are translated into quotidian and secular concerns. I mean, religion is extremely hard to live out. And the three major religions that have their roots in the Fertile Crescent, as they used to call it, are all demanding of actions. They all have relationships to power implicit in them. And, I mean, to act them out, to exercise power in their name is almost immediately to lose hold of what is best in them. I mean, and this is something that certainly I think looking at this as an essentially an outsider, you know, I don't think that would be that the founders of Israel, the first Zionists, would argue with this. I don't think they intended Israel to represent the religion of Judaism. I think that this is something that gathered force in 1967, and you know, and has come increasingly to be the case, to the consternation of you know many people in Israel. The secular tradition was valued. I think many people within the many people of faith who are Jews who follow the religion of the prophets are hesitant at seeing any attempt to translate the faith this ancient faith into the power politics of the 20th century something. Inevitably, is lost. One has to compromise to live in the world.
I'm speaking to Robert Stone, and the occasion is the publication of Damascus Gate from Houghton Mifflin. Now, all of the characters here are in some way polyglot, various, mongrel. The protagonist, Chris Lucas, is Catholic by his mother, Jewish by his father. There's an African-American woman who has spent time in Somalia and Cuba. The characters are not only polyglot by birth, but by inclination. They've traveled the globe. There is all kinds of bonding of separate worlds. There is a junkie musician, senator's son, who is acting as apostle to the central Messiah figure here, joining the world of deals, drugs, music, and faith. And so all of the book radiates to one of its central statements. The Messiah figure says, "Everything is Torah," or in other places, "All the holy is holy." Every kind of holiness and fall from the holy is part of the central characterization of divinity, that these are, he looks in their eyes and he sees flecks, and I assume that these are flecks of holiness that have fallen everywhere. No distinction is being made between individual faiths or types of holiness, which seems to be the goal of the book in a way, the uniting of these holies.
This is, you know, the concept with which the writer falls in love. That's the writer meaning me, not my character. As this syncretic faith took shape, modeled in some ways on other syncretic Gnostic faiths, modeled, I suppose, very distantly on a long ago reading of Plumed Serpent with its character's attempt to restore the religion of Quetzalcoatl. I think if I had a distant prototype, it was that, and that's a book I can't even remember. But as this syncretic religion took form, I wanted it to be more and more attractive, and I wanted De Kuff in his madness to speak for a certain wisdom. He, in a way, echoes the sentiments of William James about, you know, that what James called the perennial philosophy, that oneness of what is holy, that is a recognition either of a certain psychological aspect of each human being, or perhaps an intimation of something out there. We can't be certain, but it is as though, you know, holiness is there in some form. It may be within us, it may be outside us, but stripped of its doctrines and practices, it seems to me that it is finally one in the way that humankind is finally one.
I wanted the listeners to be able to hear the sense of mixtures of crowds and throngs and differences and antipathies. And so I've asked Robert Stone to read from the first chapter of Damascus Gate, where you will hear the madmen's, the swirl of faiths, and the strange, almost ununitable dichotomies within the holy city itself. Robert Stone from the first chapter of Damascus Gate.
In the main street of the Christian quarter, a promiscuous babble of pilgrims hurried down the sloping cobbled pavement. One group of Japanese followed a sandaled Japanese friar who held a green pennant aloft. There was a party of Central American Indians of uniform size and shape who stared with blissful incomprehension into the unconvincing smiles of merchants offering knick-knacks. There were Sicilian villagers and Boston Irish, Filipinos, more Germans, Breton women in native dress, Spaniards, Brazilians, Quebecois. Palestinian hustlers hissed suggestively, offering guidance. Lucas noticed that the Caravan Bar, his favorite beer joint in the old city, was shuttered. He had heard something about threats. Cutting through the new bazaar, he became aware of another closing. Above one of the embroidery shops, there had been a loft that once sold not only brass pipes and narguilas, but excellent hashish to smoke in them. Now both shop and loft were derelict. Since the Intifada, Lucas had taken to buying his hashish where the thin, handsome German hippies bought theirs, at a kiosk near the Arab bus terminal on Saladin Street. The police never seemed to interfere, Lucas had noticed, probably because the seller was one of their informers. In the courtyard before the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, he was reunited with the mass of pilgrims. Green-bearded troopers of the border police were stationed at every approach to the church and on the adjoining rooftops. Under their guns, the Japanese friar was addressing his flock above the noise of the throng. The Japanese groups were composed largely of middle-aged women who wore dark jumpers and khaki rain hats of the sort once favored by kibbutzniks. The priest would be telling them, Lucas imagined, the story of Constantine and his mother, St. Helena, how she had discovered the Holy Sepulchre and the very rood itself. The Japanese ladies were a motherly lot, and Lucas thought they appeared to like the story. Why not, since it had a pious mother, a dutiful son, and a miracle? Then all at once he found himself calculating ages. It had occurred to him that the Franciscan and his party might have come from Nagasaki. Nagasaki had been the most Christian of Japan's cities. All through the war, the Japanese had thought the Americans spared it air raids for that reason. In the sooty, incensed hollows of the church, he made his way through the rotunda to the undistinguished Catholic chapel in the far corner, moving just ahead of the Japanese. A glum Italian monk stood at the door, snubbing pilgrims who tried to smile at him. Inside the chapel, some Americans with guitars were plinking unhappily away, accompanying their own sad sing-along of a few socially responsible with it numbers from the sacred liturgy of whatever cow college town they called home. Like many visitors, they had been unnerved by the inimitable creepiness of the Holy Sepulchre, a grimly gaudy theopathical Turkish bathhouse where their childhood saints glared like demented spooks from every moldering wall. Lucas, once born, once baptized, put his hand in the holy water and crossed himself. Dark is life, is death, he thought. It was all that came to mind. The text was from Mahler's Song of the Earth, but he supposed it might be considered a sort of prayer. My heart is still and awaits its hour.
Robert Stone, reading from the first chapter of Damascus Gate. Now, all of these themes, religious, political, have eventually to be organized into the structure of a novel, because after all, this is fiction is the revealed world through the particular. How did you come to organize these materials? It seems almost an impossible task.
Well, it seemed almost impossible to me. I mean, in a way, there's a level of mystery to it. I really didn't think I was going to ever get myself on the other side of this book. I mean, it caused me times of tremendous stress and depression and near despair. I mean, partly because I think I had a righteous fear. You know, a godly fear of the power of the subject that I was invoking, and I'm not indifferent to it. I mean, I try to keep my humor, which like so many of us, I think I live. That's the bottom line for me. I tried to keep that operative, but it was daunting. To follow the realist mode, which I've chosen to do, to follow the considerations of plot and to make the plot stand up, was very difficult. It was quite taxing, and sometimes, you know, it made me curse and swear about, you know, realism and mode and attempting to imitate causality and the whole business of plot. And why not dispense with it? Because do we really know how one thing leads to another? Are realistic novels anything like life? And sometimes I took leave of realism when I wanted to make the djinn appear. I had just had her appear.
I love her name. Her name is Diphtheria. she is the daughter of
Rudolf Steiner. Yeah.
Yes, yes, a kind of metaphysical. What is theosophist?
Right,
yes,
right.
Yes, yes. Who whose advice, as it turns out, is, if certainly rather practical.
Right. Yes. Yeah, right.
Now, in many ways, I think of several forebears for the Robert Stone novel, among them on the political or thriller level of the intrigued life in the sordid world. There's Graham Greene, but more particularly for me, I find again and again the figure of Malcolm Lowry. And both in the synesthesia, the uniting of the senses, the breaching of the inner world and the outer world. But I guess in particular, the spiritual brokenness. You haven't allowed yourself a figure like the Council in Under the Volcano to unify the vision of this book. Rather, it's a vast cast of characters, which makes things for the novelist all the harder, because there is not finally a failed but synthesizing vision. And I wondered about that decision to keep away ultimately from a heroic Lear-like character at the center.
I think there was too much. I think I felt there was too much to put on a single Lear-like character. I mean, as Lowry does in Under the Volcano, absolutely. He puts all that on one consciousness. I think as a compulsive writer of dialogue and as a, you know, as a guy in love with story, I had to have the different characters to lay it off on. I mean, otherwise, I wouldn't be able to dramatize a lot of it in dialogue. I've always thought that probably the highest point in all of literature, you know, when you invoke Lear, is when Lear sees Edgar disguised as Tom of Bedlam, and he says, "Thou art the thing itself. Unaccommodated man is no more than such a poor bare-forked creature as thou art." That seems to me the height, the greatest line in all of English literature. And, you know, not being Shakespeare, I can't make a character to carry that much weight. You know, that seems to me to be, you know, the crowning insight, the crowning moment of human discovery in literature. And in a way, I think about that scene often because when I was an actor, part of the time I was on stage in a production of Lear in Santa Cruz, and I was Kent. So I was kind of holding on to Lear while he had this moment, and invariably it made my hair stand on end.
A final question. The epigraph of the book is from Herman Melville's epic poem, Clarel, and it reads, "Enigma and evasion grow, and shall we never find thee out?" Now, Melville went to the Holy Land at a point in his career when, faced with failure on every side, he went to Jerusalem, and his journals, as well as that poem, Clarel, evince the most enormous despair that one finds in, I think, the journals of any writer. It's a painful thing to watch Melville, who loves to intuit the holy and the vast everywhere in Moby Dick, to be finding only rock, to be finding it all broken. This book, although it has Melville's epigraph, does not seem ultimately like a book of despair. It really, in fact, seems like an affirmation of the existence of faith and something to be faithful to, even if its individual acolytes may fail.
Right. There is, I think, a sense of, you know, of people having blundered into truth, or seen a light. They can't cope with them, but as, you know, as Chekhov's characters are always saying, maybe those who come after them, you know, will look back on them with pity. That there is, Kafka said, there is hope, vast amounts of hope, but not for us. And this is a bit their situation. I think this is the most, in a way, the most affirmative book that I've written, the most hopeful. My characters often have glimpses of the numinous and fail to approach it. Here they approach more closely, and they may fail, but the thing itself continues, the thing itself goes on.
I've been speaking to Robert Stone. The occasion is the publication of his monumental novel, Damascus Gate, published by Houghton Mifflin. Thank you very much for coming and speaking with me.
It's always a pleasure, Michael.
My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The engineer is Jennifer Swadek. Special production assistance today from Alan Howard. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next week on Bookworm.
To the jungles you can go in books.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is made available to the public radio system by SAS, a satellite service of KCRW Santa Monica. Cassette copies of this and other Bookworm programs are available. For ordering information, call KCRW at 310-450-5183.
Books make you laugh and sing. Books tell you everything. They're your treasure, friends in prose and rhyme.
Now with Book of the Mouse, Pop Time.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air, new music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.